The Allegheny Front is made possible in part by listeners like you. To add your support, please click donate at AlleghenyFront.org.
Oil prices are in the basement, and that's meant a nosedive for job prospects in the petroleum industry.
Currently, I'm just applying to any job that's open.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the trouble with planning a future in the fossil fuel industry. You say mush, but the people behind a team of dogs have another word for getting those puppies moving.
Hike!
And which winter bird takes its name from a religious figure's majestic red robes? I bet you can spot one at your bird feeder right now. That and more is coming up, so stay with us. President Obama has put the brakes on the Keystone XL pipeline. He vetoed the bill that would allow construction of the controversial line. It would have carried Canadian tar sands oil 1,200 miles to refineries on the Gulf Coast. But with oil prices hovering around $50 a barrel, some question whether building the pipeline makes sense financially at this point. This also has some questioning a tax proposal by Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf. Since taking office, he's been traversing the state, pitching a severance tax on the oil and gas industry. He says the money raised would go towards education. Other energy-producing states already have a similar tax. But some say Wolf's timing is wrong. They say a new energy tax now could drive the industry elsewhere. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
Governor Tom Wolf says there's a solution to Pennsylvania's underfunded schools, and it's beneath the ground.
We sit on top of one of the richest deposits of natural gas in the world. We have the natural resources to actually do something about the problem here.
Wolf proposes a 5% severance tax on the value of gas produced. He's also pushing an additional flat fee based on the volume as a hedge for market swings. The package would raise $1 billion for Pennsylvania in the first year.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, if you add yet an additional tax in this kind of pricing environment, it's a recipe for disaster.
Stephanie Wissman is director of the American Petroleum Institute's Pennsylvania division. She says the state already charges an impact fee, a flat annual price on each well. And it has one of the highest corporate net income taxes in the nation, though Wolf is proposing to slash that. Wissman says now, with gas prices significantly down, drillers are not making as much profit and they can't afford a new tax.
Margins are thin as they are, but if you add yet another cost of doing business, then I have no doubt you'll see a slowdown.
Another industry trade group says a severance tax could threaten other investments, like a new multi-billion-dollar ethane cracker being considered in Beaver County.
Highly recommend.
Some say drillers are already cutting back. The smell at Hot Rod's House of Barbecue in Waynesburg in southwest Pennsylvania is sweet and thick. Servers bustle around with large trays of barbecue sandwiches. Owner Rodney Phillips says most of their customers work for energy companies with wells in the area.
We wouldn't be here without the gas and oil industry.
But Phillips says business is down 20 to 30% since last summer.
I've seen them let guys go home at noon. I've never seen that. Usually it's just the opposite. Dudes, we're working 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're rolling steady.
And what do you think's going on?
It's a slowdown. There's no money in it right now.
But what looks like a slowdown to workers actually may be the mark of industry improvements. That's according to Parth Vaishnaw, a graduate researcher in economics and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
The industry has responded to the low prices not by running away, not by stopping, but by innovating and becoming more efficient and producing gas more cheaply.
Vaishnaw and his team analyzed the impact of a severance tax in Pennsylvania and found at the rates proposed by Governor Wolf, the industry is still profitable. But Washington County Commissioner Larry Maggi still worries. He says the oil and gas industry has been a godsend for their economy. But with profit margins already slim, a new tax could push the industry away.
We're right next to the border here. We're next to Ohio and West Virginia. And if there's too much of an onerous tax, severance tax put on the gas and oil industry, they're going to move. In some cases, only 5 or 6 miles west. It's not very far where some of them have to move.
But Governor Wolf points out that every other energy-producing state already levies a severance tax. His is modeled on West Virginia's tax. And in Ohio, Republican Governor John Kasich is pushing for an even higher severance tax than Wolf's. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Thank you.
A year ago, a petroleum engineering degree seemed like the ticket to a bright and well-paid future. With a six-figure starting salary for a bachelor's degree and optimism about the shale revolution, enrollment climbed rapidly in petroleum engineering programs across the country. But now that the oil price slide has turned into an oil price slump, the luster is wearing off. Stephanie Joyce of Wyoming Public Radio reports for Inside Energy.
It's been a roller coaster couple of years for Evan Lowry. When he first enrolled at the University of Wyoming, his plan was to be a chemical engineer, like his dad. But the oil industry was booming, and he quickly changed his mind.
Switched based off of the outlook for petroleum engineers.
An outlook that included not only exceptional compensation, but also near certainty of finding a job. When I spoke with him last April for a story about a shortage of petroleum engineers in regulatory jobs, he said he wouldn't consider working for the government.
As far as the salary goes, it's kind of hard to go with something like that, I guess, when there's so many other opportunities in the industry.
Today, with oil prices at half what they were in June and companies potentially laying off hundreds of thousands of people, Lowry is eating those words.
Currently, I'm just applying to any job that's open. I think I'm at about 35 or 36 right now.
He's also back where he started. He's enrolling in a chemical engineering master's degree, just in case none of those jobs pan out. And Lowry isn't the only one. At the Colorado School of Mines, Professor Carrie McClelland says plenty of her students are in that boat. Every fall, she invites a guest speaker to her class, and he always opens with a question about how many students have jobs lined up after graduation.
Usually 75 to 80% of the people would raise their hand, but we maybe had 10 or 15 students raise their hand this year.
She says some seniors have had offers rescinded, and plenty of students are suddenly considering graduate school. But McClelland is quick to point out that oil prices aren't the only problem. She says there are just too many students these days pursuing petroleum engineering degrees.
I think the demand has already leveled off, even though the number of students continues to increase. And we're going to see a lot of students that end up with a petroleum engineering degree but have to go find a job in a different industry.
The School of Mines has seen enrollment double since 2010, according to an Inside Energy data analysis, while the University of Wyoming and the University of North Dakota have seen even larger increases. Vladimir Alvarado is the head of Wyoming's Petroleum Engineering Department. He says so far, there are no signs that surge in students is abating.
We won't see the impact just yet simply because there is inertia in the market. They will not stop all of a sudden.
And he doesn't want it to, although he would like to see it slow. Class sizes in recent years have overwhelmed the university's teaching staff and put a huge strain on department resources. Alvarado says in light of that, low oil prices may be a good thing.
It'll give us time to catch our breath and, you know, improve.
But what Alvarado doesn't want is a repeat of the 1980s. In the early part of that decade, students also flocked to petroleum engineering programs amid high oil prices, and then cleared out just as suddenly when the industry busted. The University of Wyoming ended up shutting down the entire program, something that clearly is on Alvarado's mind these days.
If we are clever, we can sustain, you know, healthy activity even with fewer students, even if it goes down like before. We need to avoid, you know, panicking about this and shutting down programs. It's very expensive to restart a program.
Oil prices would have to stay low for years for anyone to talk seriously about shutting things down. But as with many things oil, whether it be a drilling frenzy or an enrollment surge, it may prove difficult to strike a balance between the extremes. For Inside Energy, I'm Stephanie Joyce in Wyoming.
Thanks to Inside Energy for that story. It's a public media collaboration focusing on America's energy issues. A brownish female cardinal doesn't catch the eye like her flashy red male counterpart. But when it comes to singing a tune, the female knows how to get attention.
She sang, "Hurry up with the food, we're hungry."
Don't keep mama cardinals waiting. That's coming up on an all-new Bird Files on the Allegheny Front. Stick around. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Our region is rich in freshwater resources, and the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh has a new exhibit called H2O. That's H2O. OH! About the city's rivers and water issues in general. And here to talk with me about H2O is Dennis Bateman, the director of exhibits and theaters here at the Science Center. Dennis, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
So the Science Center is located along a river. I think that's the Ohio River, just outside the window. How does the river out there play into the exhibits inside?
We have a couple of things about the rivers right outside. We have an infrared camera that we mounted to our roof, and visitors can look and see the relative temperature of the rivers visually rather than just with numbers and data. And you can actually see that even though the rivers might look like they're the same, because we're right here at the confluence where the Allegheny and the Monongahela come together to form the Ohio, what looks like one single Ohio River for about a mile downstream is still two rivers of two different temperatures, two different speeds, two different clarities until they mix up. So visitors can look at that. Of course, being the Science Center, we have to go with like heavy duty arcade game interactive controls. So we have a game throttle that you can just move back and forth and pan and tilt up and down the river and see what you can see.
It looks very different from what's out there now. It's pinks and purples and reds.
And you can see the Mon right now, which is warmer, doesn't have any ice on it, and is showing up at a different color than the Allegheny, which shows up oranger.
Yeah, it's very well frozen over right now out there, and I wanted to know what other kind of exhibits you might have that might showcase how the seasons affect the rivers or how people experience the rivers.
We have a whole water table over here. We're talking about the water cycle, and in the spring when there's more rain and it raises the height of the rivers, and we just got a big old crank, because of course the problem with the water cycle is you got to evaporate the water, and that would take forever. So we just have the kids turn a crank and it pumps up and starts raining out of the clouds.
It's raining out of sort of like a little flower-shaped cloud at the top of the exhibit.
And it rains down the hillside, which has been designed to be the sort of glacially shaved off mountain or hills that we have in our region. And what I liked about this when we actually put it in last week was you're standing here looking at this and you look out at Mount Washington and it's the same sort of shape, the same steepness. And being Pittsburgh, on a lot of days, visitors will be able to see it rain on Mount Washington and make it rain on our little Mount Washington here. And then the water flows down into two rivers where we've got a hydroelectric plant. We've got locks and dams they can move their boats through, islands you can move around and learn about how water flow is affected by land masses. For instance, the and again, looking right out the window, the habitat between the submarine and our shore is different than it is in the rest of the river, because the presence of the submarine shades the water and slows it down. So we actually have a slightly different ecosystem right out the window than the rest of the area has.
The submarine's part of the Science Center.
Yes.
Talk about some of the ways that the exhibits here address water from different angles, from different scientific lenses, for example, biology, chemistry, or physics.
As far as chemistry, we talk about pH. It's one of the things that we're monitoring in the river, and then there's a column in the gallery that explains what pH is and how that affects life in the river. Working on the research for this, we learned that the pH of the Mon in the heyday of the steel industry was sometimes as acidic as tomato juice.
Wow.
It was also occasionally over 100 degrees closer to the plants from the discharge that they put out. So given a 100-degree glass of tomato juice, there was not a lot of life in the Mon. It was actually a dead river. Now it's got new life in it, new fish are returning to it, big fish, in fact. We have some fish out in our rivers that are 4 and 5 feet long.
So wildlife is part of this experience as well.
It is. We're focusing on native freshwater species. You know, a lot of kids, well, a lot of adults now probably too, you don't see much more than a squirrel or a pigeon. We want to again make that connection that the rivers that most people just drive over on their way someplace else actually have a lot of diversity and life in them.
Let's take a look.
This is the bullfrog right now. He's about, what, the size of my thumb. Eventually he'll be bigger than my hand, and he is hiding out in here. We only have one because bullfrogs are very territorial and they're cannibalistic, so he's going to be living a happy but solitary life in there.
One of the things I noticed about the exhibit is a row of toilets. There's a row of toilets on either side, and I think that they're meant to be sat on as benches. Am I correct?
They are. We took out the regular benches in the gallery and put in toilets because you can't have a water exhibit without some toilets in there. But then we also have interesting facts about combined sewer overflow and plumbing to get people thinking about what happens in their house and how that affects the rivers. Most people in Pittsburgh live within walking distance, relatively easy walking distance, of a creek or a run or a river or something. And how does that water get to the Ohio? How does the Ohio water get into our homes back as clean drinking water? And talk about that whole cycle.
Our region is very rich in water resources and rain, but that's not true for a lot of other places, and water conservation, I know, is something that this exhibit is targeting.
The centerpiece of the gallery, when you first walk in, we call the water chandelier.
So the 1 gallon paint cans that are dangling above our head represent
all of the water in the world, and then that's 44 gallons in this scale. Then you get down to 3 quarts, which is all of the water in the polar ice caps. You get down to 6 pints, which is all of the lake water, down to sort of a tomato paste 6-ounce can, which is the water vapor in the atmosphere, down to a thimble of river water, and then down to the drop of treated water, which is about the same size as the river water because we can continually treat it and, you know, flush it and treat it and flush it.
You have a scale. It's sort of, is it a scale for people or?
It is. It's just an old fashioned like soda fountain scale from the 20s that we bought on eBay and recalibrated it. So it shows what percentage of you is water.
Can you test it out for me?
Sure. Ooh, I'm up to 170. yeah, 170 pounds, 102 pounds of water, and 12 3/4 gallons of water. Different parts of your body are made up of different percentages of water. For instance, your kidneys are 83% water. Your bones are only 22% water. And babies are more watery, as parents probably are not surprised to find out, than you are as you get older. And you can only live 3 days without water. You can go a couple of weeks without food, but only 3 days without water. So it's it's an important resource personally, you know, for ourselves, for our own health.
Why is it important? Why do you want people, visitors, to interact with this river, this water exhibit now? Why is this an important time in the region's history to examine water issues?
Our rivers are on the rebound from where they were in the heyday of the industrial age in Pittsburgh. The health of the region is determined by the health of the rivers. And as the rivers come back, we know that our environment is getting healthier. We're not by any means saying mission accomplished. There's a lot that's going to be going on in our region. As we try to maintain the progress that we've made, look out for any new dangers that might be out there.
Well, Dennis, thank you so much for showing us around.
Well, thanks for coming in and having a look around.
I've been speaking with Dennis Bateman, Director of Exhibits and Theaters here at the Carnegie Science Center, about their new exhibit, H2O, Exploring the Region's Waterways. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Invasive species like Asian carp are another threat to fresh water, pushing out native species and causing a headache for conservationists. Now they're invading the internet, too. But this time it's a good thing. Rebecca Williams reports on a project to digitize collections of species that aren't native to the Great Lakes.
1.7 million specimens will be going online over the next few years. Ken Cameron directs the Wisconsin State Herbarium at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's leading the project. He and his collaborators will be pulling fish and mollusks out of jars and taking dried plants out of drawers, photographing them, and uploading them to the online collection along with data about the species.
We wanted to get those data out and available and over the internet to democratize them, basically.
Cameron says there's a wealth of information inside museums that will now be available to anyone with an internet connection. There are at least 180 non-native species already living in the Great Lakes, but the scientists will be putting more than 2,500 species online.
Not only are there species in the Great Lakes of great concern, but there are a number currently listed on watch lists. We know that they're getting close. They have the potential to become invasive within the Great Lakes Basin, and those are the ones in particular that we're monitoring and tracking their spread.
He says it's also important to target species that are closely related to known invaders and species that are lookalikes. Cameron says they're hoping to use the online database to help track the spread of invasive species and species that could become invasive.
One of the most exciting aspects to the work is that our data is based on physical vouchered specimens. They're not rumors, they're not reports, they're actually verified physical specimens.
Some of the specimens are hundreds of years old. Cameron says the database will allow scientists to track the point of origin of a species and look for patterns in the data. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
There's no doubt it's been a cold and snowy winter in the Northeast, but that actually makes some folks happy, mushers and sled dogs. Racing across a frozen landscape isn't just for Alaskans. Dog sledding is popular in our neck of the woods, too. I recently visited some enthusiasts in Laurel Mountain State Park in Westmoreland County to find out more about the sport.
Stay.
Matt Phillips and Sarah White are unloading precious cargo, their dogs, from the back seat of a black hatchback.
This is Sitka. He's a long-haired woolly husky, which is a purebred Siberian husky, but it's a different genetic trait than people are used to with the longer fur.
And they have another dog, Koske. He's a German Shepherd husky mix with short brown fur and pointy black ears.
So why did you decide to become a musher, a dog sledder?
Koske showed up at my friend's doorstep Easter 2 years ago, so I brought him home. And he was just full of energy, and I would run him with my bike and stuff like that. But over the winter, I was like, he's half husky. I should give this a shot. See if he knows how to do the dog sledding thing.
So we found this group, West Penn Mushers, online.
Oh, there's your buddies. There's your buddies. Soon as they know they're going mushing, they start howling and howling, and they love it.
That's Karen Bodai. She's also pretty new to the group. Phillips is borrowing her blue-eyed therapy dog, Apache. That way Phillips can take me out on the sled.
This is a four-dog line, so we're going to just hook two of them together so we can use it as a three-dog line for us today. It's just a long leash, and then the sled has bungees underneath of it where it's hooked on so that it absorbs some of the shock from the dogs going forward and backwards a bunch. All right, you want to go start hooking them up? Apache, are you ready to go? We're going to put Koske in the lead. All right, ready? Hike! Good dogs, good dogs, hike! Once they get the idea, once they see other dogs doing it, they pick it up in a hurry.
We're traveling about 10 miles an hour down a completely snow-covered road, but Phillips says you don't need more than a couple of inches. It's flying up under the dog's feet. Phillips calls this a slow trot.
Keep it up, hike, come on. Hike means let's go. A lot of people think it's mush. I think some movies and cartoons and stuff like that kind of gave the misinformation there. Mush is just the sport name. Good dogs. All right, Koske, back haw. Koske, come here, back haw.
Back haw. Koske. That means turn around to the left. It almost works. Koske looks like he'd rather run off and play in the woods to either side of us.
As well as he follows the directions for the most part, he also has an attitude. Come on, Koske, hike! Good dog, take us home.
The dogs come in for a landing in the parking lot and lap up some much-deserved water after they're unhooked from the sled. Between runs is a good time for the mushers to trade tips and learn from one another. Beth Talentire has been mushing for 25 years. Her big white Samoyeds are show dogs, and they wear pink booties to protect their paws.
Teach woe first, because I lost my team one time.
You lost what?
My team. They want to run, man.
It's addicting.
It is addicting. I'm really happy when somebody new comes up.
The Facebook group's grown a lot recently. It's up to over 200 people. And Phillips is hoping to grow his pack, too. He says he doesn't have anything against cats, but he's a dog person. And for him, the appeal of the sport is simple.
It's nice to just be out here, be in the nature, being with the dogs. Finding the elements for what they are.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapple.
Who let the dogs out?
And according to some in his mushers group, Matt Phillips is helping spread new interest in the sport by posting videos. He straps a camera to his chest while he's on the sled to see how his dogs perform. So now you can be a virtual musher, sledding through downtown Pittsburgh. That's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org.
I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds.
If there was a popularity contest for birds, the northern cardinal would surely be one of the winners. With its bright red plumage and its spiky crest and its upbeat, lively song, the cardinal is a welcome sight, particularly on a cold winter day. For the Allegheny Front's Bird Files, Margaret Brittingham has more.
The cardinal is a bird that is familiar to even the casual bird watcher. It is the state bird for 7 states, more than any other species, and is a common bird in backyards and wooded edges across the eastern and central U.S. The female is a warm brown and tan with patches of red on the wings, tail, and crest. But it's the bright red males that most people recognize and that inspired their name. Their color is reminiscent of the red vestments worn by Roman Catholic cardinals. As with many bird species, this plumage brightness is associated with mate quality. In cardinals, brighter males have better territories, higher nest success, and take on a greater role in feeding the young. This allows females to prepare for subsequent nesting attempts. Both the male and female cardinals sing, which is unusual. In most species, only the male sings. Songs are used to defend a territory, to enhance the pair bond between the male and female, and to communicate important pieces of information between the pair. For example, when nesting, the female stays on the nest and the male brings food to her while she incubates and broods the young. When the male is nearby, he sings to the female. Researchers at the University of Wisconsin found that if she matches his song by singing the same notes, she's saying, "Stay away, we're not hungry right now." However, if she sings a different tune, she's saying, "Hurry up with the food, we're hungry." Both males and females have large conical beaks, ideal for crushing and cracking open seeds. They also eat grapes and other fruit, insects, and invertebrates such as beetles and snails. Both can be aggressive when defending their territory, and sometimes this aggression becomes misplaced, as when a cardinal will continue to attack its own reflection in a window. We once had a cardinal we called Bonkers because it pecked at our family room window daily from February through July for 2 years straight. Cardinals are year-round residents, meaning they don't migrate to warmer climates in winter, but instead tough it out near where they bred during the summer. So wherever you are, you're likely to hear the cheer, cheer, cheer of the brilliant red cardinal. For the Allegheny Front Bird Files, I'm Margaret Brittingham.
Thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the bird calls heard in that story. And if you're a fan of this segment, Bird Files is on Twitter, at AFrontBirds. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. Julie Grant's our managing editor. I'm Kara Holsapple. And I was really taken with the dogs I met while mushing and their names. Sitka, Apache, Trixie. If your dog has an unusual name, share it with us on Twitter, at Allegheny Front. And join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Laurel Foundation, and the Thompson Foundation, administered by the PNC Charitable Trust. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.